Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. A little start, then a restart. Bill Arnold here. It is Tuesday, October 10th. My little sister Amy's birthday. So happy birthday, Amy. But I know you're not listening because you're not up yet. Anyway, I want to start with a passage from Proverbs 19. It says, listen to advice and accept discipline. And at the end, you will be counted among the wise. Many are the plans in a person's heart, but it is the Lord's purpose that prevails. There's another great passage in Proverbs in 19, verse 3. It says, a man's own foolish acts destroy his life, but his heart is angry with the Lord. It's like you ruin your own life, and then you're mad at God. That's pretty crazy. Shakespeare said, the wise man knows himself to be a fool. The fool thinks himself to be wise. I was thinking of an incident that happened in Texas. Brilliant. These two robbers decided to rob a store that sells security cameras. Yep, they're trying to steal the exact thing that criminals are supposed to try to avoid. So as you would imagine, it kind of goes downhill from there. 17 functioning security cameras in the store pretty much caught them in the act of stuffing $10,000 worth of surveillance equipment into garbage cans. Now, it's kind of impressive that they were able to take all of that in a minute and 15 seconds. So way to work hard. Just need to channel your energy somewhere else. But it also doesn't make up for the fact that there was one part of the security camera that perfectly filmed their license plate as they were driving away, which allowed the police to track their names, of which, when they got to court, they still pled not guilty. So you can blow up your own life and then be mad at God. Shakespeare again said, the wise man knows himself to be a fool. The fool thinks himself to be wise. You know, I think in a way we've medicalized sin in our culture. You're not a thief anymore. You've got kleptomania. You've got a condition. It's got to be dealt with. Maybe go to some group. But sin is sin, and we're going to talk about a movie with Jason Pamer. He is the director and producer and writer of a movie called Heart of a Man. It's going to be a one-night event coming up in 1 week from tonight. So we're going to find out more about that after the break. Be back with Jason Pamer. It is 6 minutes after the hour. Good morning. Welcome back to the show. So glad you're with us today on October 17th. We're going to have a great opportunity to see The Heart of Man. It's a movie that is produced by Jason Pamer. He is my guest on the studio line, and he is here to talk about it. Jason, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Let's talk a little bit about the movie, The Heart of Man. A little synopsis of it would be nice to get things started.
Yeah, the film is a deconstructed look at the prodigal son story, the ancient father-son story, and that's intertwined with real poignant stories of brokenness from people around the country, people like Paul Young, author of The Shack, Jackie Hill Perry, spoken word artist. And these two genres are combined to ultimately reveal the compassionate heart of God the Father for us in the midst of our darkest moments.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Jason, it kind of reorient.
Yeah. Yep. And Jason, you're the producer of this film?
Producer, writer, yep.
Sweet. Now, what is it like to just be at a dinner party and have somebody say to you, so, Jason, what do you do? And you go, movie producer.
I make something else up. I'm kidding. No. Yeah. There's no day that is like the day before. So I do like that.
That's true. Yep. And you do wear a lot of hats in this business. And it's not as glamorous as one might think, is it?
Not at all.
Yeah. No. It's a lot of hard work.
Except when you hop on a morning show, Bill Arnold.
Thank you.
That's the good life.
Thank you. So, and this movie was shot in Hawaii. So that's another grueling day at the office.
18, 19-hour days. I'm not sure many people have experienced those in Hawaii. But yes, we did about 3 weeks over there to shoot the narrative, the deconstructed look at the prodigal son story. And then we shot the documentary portion all around the country, all around the U.S.
Now, when we talk about relating to leaving our brokenness behind and trying to encounter God in a new, fresh way, and once we begin to know God as a result of who he is and who we are, we can start living life differently and showing the world something else, can't we?
Yeah, and we kind of look at it as maybe not as much leaving the brokenness behind, but looking at it in front of us and going, instead of that being a barrier to the heart of God, it's actually a bridge that he's going to come over and access my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And the very thing that I think separates me is the very thing he wants to enter into. And he wants to enter into it to discover, why am I in that moment? What am I really searching for? What am I going after? What does my heart really want?
Yeah. So, Jason, let me ask you a personal question. Is this personal for you?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. This story, this film, is a reflection of my story.
Okay.
In my journey. And you know, it's changed and reoriented my paradigm of God. It's kind of removed a religious caricaturing of him. And many, you know, it's exposed things in my own heart and life that I need to continue to bring to light. And, yeah, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
This film is not for other people. It's for the filmmakers themselves, for sure.
Okay. So we're always trying to manage our behavior, and we're always kind of presenting to the world the person that we want the world to see. And that's not always who lives inside, is it?
Yeah, and the sad, sad irony is everyone's doing that to some degree. And that's because we believe this insidious lie of shame, which whispers, you're the only one that's struggling with this. Don't reveal it to anybody else. They wouldn't want to be with you. They wouldn't want to even look at you, gaze upon you if they knew. And the irony is every one of us is hearing that same voice, and we believe in it, and so we live in isolation. And I think that's the real ploy of the enemy.
Mm-hmm. Jason, when we talk about things like addictions and maybe habits or compulsive behaviors and the way we can live with secrets and double lives, how are we doing and how is the church doing in terms of addressing those issues and letting people feel comfortable enough to start talking about that in church?
You know, I think there's examples all around the world of churches doing it really well and doing it right. I think in my North American evangelical context, on the aggregate, the business model is not set up for that. You don't have the freedom to be vulnerable and open and transparent from the pulpit. It's not a good career choice. If you don't live a certain way and walk, you know, a certain way. Now, there are qualifications for leaders, no doubt. But to not be able to be open from up there, I think impacts the pews.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think it does not breed a sense of like, oh, I can be free. I can walk out in the light.
Yeah.
If they can't do it, how am I supposed to do it?
Exactly. Jason, what do you think we should do in terms of having pastors being vulnerable from the platform and the pulpit and showing their vulnerabilities versus just focusing on the centrality of Christ and hoping that the Holy Spirit will help people work out their issues and having maybe more community in small groups?
Well, I think the way that God has always done work is through story. I mean, this is the way that Jesus communicated while he was on earth.
Yeah.
Through story. And I think, you know, there's no better story to be able to reveal than your own story. As it's kind of reflected on or it's revealed by the bigger story, the macro story, the meta story, story of God. And I think that human beings are meant for community and meant for connection. And so to not reveal that part, to not open up that part of one's life, to some degree, to a healthy degree, I don't think is helpful.
Yeah.
I think it should be a part of the overall story.
Yeah. And Jason, you also say that shame should be not a barrier, but a bridge. So maybe talk about that and talk about how people are carrying around all this shame.
Yeah. I mean, I think the very thing that we think separates us is the thing that is actually a bridge. There's this Latin phrase, felix culpa, which is sort of the zenith of man's sin. The cross is the zenith of God's grace. The worst thing that humanity could bring to the table to try to kill God himself is the very thing that unleashed the greatest gift ever given.
Mm.
It took one moment in time in one place in time to do that. And I think that's the macro. On the micro, these moments that we think should isolate and separate us, and we got to wait at least 2-3 weeks until I can have a good amount of good behavior before I can reapproach him is actually not accurate at all. He wants to enter into these moments where I'm relapsing or giving back into something, and he wants to discover why I'm there and mm-hmm. what my heart's searching for, and then provide a better yes.
Mm-hmm.
And that better yes is a winsome, wooing invite that over enough time will ultimately change my behavior. But so, when we just start the behavior and focus on the behavior,
right.
we go into the sin management category. And then when I can't deliver, more shame is reaped on me, and therefore more bad behavior to sort of alleviate that. I got to go get that dopamine rush, you know, that epinephrine. I got to go get those chemicals to be able to have reprieve, momentary reprieve. And so whatever I've given my mind to that gives me that immediate feedback loop, that's what I'm going to go to.
Mm. Jason, let me take a little break. I'm speaking to Jason Paymer. He is the producer and writer of a movie called The Heart of Man, and it's going to be in theaters coming up October 17th. All you got to do is go to the website, and you will be directed right to a theater in your neck of the woods where you can go see it. We'll take a short break and be back with Jason Paymer in just a minute. Welcome back to the show. I'm speaking to Jason Paymer. He is a writer, a producer of a film called The Heart of Man, not his first one, and it's going to be in theaters October 17th. And if you head over to the website, we'll put that up on our website information. Jason, what is the name of the website?
Yeah, that's just heartofmanmovie.com.
Heart of Man.
Tickets.
Yes, heartofmanmovie.com/tickets, and you can find out what theater.
Yeah, you put in your zip code. Yep,
yes.
Exactly.
I did that, and it was really easy, and I know exactly what theater I'm going to.
It's great.
Yeah. So as we talk about shame and we talk about managing your sin, I thought that was an interesting expression you used, but we need to use this as a bridge to transformation, not a bridge to and not an obstacle to just staying stuck.
Yeah, yeah. He wants, again, to come over that thing that we think is insurmountable. And that's ultimately what he did, but it's what he wants to continue to do. He wants to continue to cross over that divide and gap. And, you know, I think in my context, again, it's not everybody's, but in mine, I grew up with this sort of view that God the Father was this distant, pissed off deity that couldn't look on me because I had sinned.
Mm-hmm.
If Jesus wasn't around me, I'm exposed. There's no way he can look at me. And so I think that has been reframed for me, that post the cross, I'm a completely new creation. I have a shame-free identity. And that's an ontological discussion, and there's a theology, you know, that gets espoused in the film in a kind of, I think, a subtle artistic way. But it is there, that we are good beings and that we were made in the image of a good God.
Jason, I agree. Don't you think that we all have at some point some bad information about God? And in order to learn about the biblical truth of God, it might mean that we have to unlearn some stuff that we learned before that isn't true?
Oh, yeah. And it comes two primary ways. One is the church, right? You get taught a certain thing, and that's been passed down generation to generation. And I think this sort of gap theology helps sort of give us a reason to have lists of things to do and hold people accountable to. It just creates a paradigm that mm-hmm. we can then give into easily. And then secondarily, we all have a frame of reference for God the Father through our earthly father. Many of us broken, shattered, marred, even really great examples, obviously are going to fall short, right? And so as we try to frame up who God the Father is, our immediate context for that relationship is going to be the earthly version of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is going to impact everyone differently. And that's why that relationship, father, son, is represented at the core of the film's message.
Yeah. Jason, I saw an interview on the internet, which you were talking about just doing things with excellence. So it instantly caught my attention. And I thought, I like this guy already. And just as a side note, you sound on this interview just the way you sound on the video I watched.
Gravelly, sexy.
Totally, all of that. Yeah, it's all there. Just so you know.
But yeah, that comment, that was, you know, there was a cobbler back in Martin Luther's day who approached you know, the theologian Martin Luther and was like, how can I be a good Christian cobbler?
Yeah.
And Martin Luther was quoted as saying, you know, well, you don't need to put a bunch of crosses on the shoes. Just make great shoes.
Yeah.
And I think in art, specifically Christian art, which I think is a misnomer, but that's a category that people have a frame of reference for, so I'll call it that. I just think that there's issues. That's a whole other radio interview with you, but
I know, and I'd love to have it. By the way,
yeah, we're called to something much greater. I mean, the Renaissance, you know, the thrust of it was by people of faith who created great art. And it wasn't called Christian art; it was just called great art,
right?
And it happened to be crafted by people that have a paradigm and a worldview shaped around this sort of cosmic creator God. I think my Catholic colleagues and counterparts, at least on the filmmaking side, get it a lot easier because their whole context is very visually oriented. And obviously there's a line that can be crossed there, right? But
sure.
I think they get it. Like their whole thing, aesthetics is a big deal. In the Christian faith, at least in North America, it's about, it's very didactic. This mm-hmm. is how you should think. This is how you should read. This is how you should pray. This is how you should, it's laid out. Not much room for mystery or imagination.
Yeah.
Because where that is, darkness lies. And where darkness lies, we all know who's there waiting, crouching to get us.
Right, right. And I think we come from the same school that says, don't expect me to like your crummy play if it's crummy just because you're calling yourself a Christian.
Oh, yeah. In fact, I think it's an indictment. It's embarrassing. And now, listen, that's not to say that everything I touch or even the heart of man itself, there's no gaps or marks or blemishes or things I wish we could redo. There
sure.
absolutely
are. Of course
are.
There is.
I just think 4 years ago when we sensed that this is what we were supposed to do, it would not have been enough to just try to go do it without setting up things and checks and balances and raising money and trying to get enough money, although there's never enough money, but really pushing through all that and getting the best out of everyone that came on the team
mm-hmm.
and versus just kind of going, hey, we're called to it. Let's just kind of put it together and trust that because we're called to it and Scott, it's oriented around him, he's going to figure it out for us on our behalf.
Yeah.
Now, I think undoubtedly, you know, major milestones all throughout this film and ultimately the power it contains, I think, has got his fingerprints on it. But it required an earthly involvement from a couple hundred artisans around the world to take significant time and sacrifice and pour their lives into something. And it was that unique mix that I think is ultimate. He wants to co-create with us. And that's part of the Imago Dei.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's part of the reflection of that. So we just got to lean into that.
So with just about a minute left, Jason, is there a demographic that it leans more towards going to see this movie? What exactly do we hope people will see in this story?
Well, you know, it's very cliche to say it's for everybody, but the really great thing is we now have data sets that say it is for a 14-year-old to a 72-year-old.
Okay.
From a Midwest Caucasian to an urban minority or suburban minority or like whatever, it doesn't matter. It affects people. And again, it's because I think at the core of it is this sort of father relationship. And we all have a visceral response to that, good or bad.
Mm-hmm.
And those of us that kind of have an indifferent response, two questions in reveals that that's actually not the case.
Yeah.
And so I think that's universal. I think the fact that the narrative doesn't have language to it allows people to come up with their own, which again opens it and broadens it. You know, our hope was to get a broad swath of sort of voice represented. And it wasn't comprehensive, but I think it was enough to give enough different groups a voice in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So I think because of all those things, and because it's a message, I think, that God wants to get across to his people, not just through this film, but there are movements all around the earth that are coalescing around this father heart of God.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's behind it. So if he's behind it, he's going to blow wind into it. And so I think that also has an appeal to the human heart. I mean, I've been in a theater with people that have an atheist worldview.
Yeah.
Before the film finished, weeping.
Yeah. Wow. That's really interesting. Jason, you've been a really interesting guest, and that's made me look good. And at the end of the day, that's all I care about.
That's all I care about.
Thanks a lot, Jason.
Thanks.
Blessings to you on your project and your future going forward. Love to have another conversation with you about excellence in art, because that's a conversation I'm quite passionate about.
Yeah, me too.
All right.
Forward to it. Thanks, Bill.
We'll take a short break and be back with more in just a minute. Good morning. It's half past the hour. What a great day we've got going here already. We've got Ben Johnson coming up in about 10 minutes. He's from the Acton Institute, the senior editor. Every time I say Acton Institute, I want to say Action Institute, because they do get things done. We're going to talk about the Trump administration's new religious liberty memo. But for now, we're going to take a break for news. Be back in a minute. Good morning. It's 25 minutes until the top of the hour. I'm really looking forward to Ben Johnson, who is already on our studio line. We're going to bring him on in just a minute. But Carolyn Haas comments on how, rather than being mad at God for our trials, we need to see them as an opportunity for him to work in our lives.
I think there's a paradigm shift that needs to happen for us, where it's so easy to say, I want to see the miraculous, and we all want to see miracles. But when it comes down to it, miracles are birthed out of tragedy and they're birthed out of pain. Honestly, we don't want it to be in our life. Like, we all want to see God move a mountain, but we don't want that mountain to be in our path. It's so much more fun to watch it in someone else's life. Or we want to see God raise the dead, but we don't want it to be our brother or our son or our daughter. Sometimes I think there's this paradigm of even how we translate hardship. And I think, you know, we forget to talk about the verse that says, Jesus said, John 16:33, in this world you will have many trials. I mean, that's not something we put on calendars or mugs or cups. Do you know what I mean? And we don't send a card and say, hey, just wanted to encourage you today. In this world you're going to have many trials. You know, but that Jesus actually said that. Now, granted, the next part of the verse says, I've overcome the world, take heart. But I think that's where we have to engage our faith and not translate hardship and trials as I've done something wrong or God has rejected me or just poor me, I'm a victim. But actually, oh my gosh, this is an opportunity. The paradigm shift. Oh, hardship, trial. I get to see a side of God I've never seen before. I get to experience a side of God that is new, that is fresh, that is who he says he is. But I wouldn't experience it if I didn't go through this hardship.
And that is just a short tease. If you want to hear that full interview, head over to myfaithradio.com and type in Carolyn Haas, H-A-S-S. Take a little break, and then Ben Johnson's going to be with us. I can't wait.
Doubting Thomas wasn't a doubter. He was a questioner. Not a bad trait for these times we live in. This is Jim Garlow. I'm sure we've all heard people who say with great confidence that God told them to do this and to do that. Well, some really bad things have occurred because of it. In contrast to that, if something comes to mind and it conforms to the Word of God, and if it's within the framework of biblical truth and wise, mature counselors around you concur, it's definitely a more sure indication that God is on the move and that you're to move with Him. It's my prayer that God raise up a bold people truly under the influence of the Holy Spirit who can and will proclaim biblical truth to the culture. My point, ordinary people, under the influence of the Holy Spirit, can do extraordinary things. There's more at jimgarlow.com. Be prepared to live out your faith.
One, two, three, four. Devil ain't lazy.
No, sorry.
He roams around with sticks and stones, passing out his moans and groans. Devil ain't
good
no
morning.
Lazy.
It's 23 minutes until the top of the hour. Ben Johnson is senior editor at the Acton Institute. His work focuses on the principles necessary to create a free and virtuous society in the transatlantic sphere. I love that introduction. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning. How are you, Bill?
I'm well. So nice to have you back on the program. Thank you for taking time to be with us.
Well, the pleasure's all mine.
Well, that I believe, because you're that nice of a person. Trust me, I know this about you.
Well, that's altogether too kind. But
well,
you do a great
you.
Show, and it's always a pleasure to be on.
Thank you. So I'd like to talk a bit about the president's pledge to offer more legal protections for people of faith.
Well, the president has kept his word in May. I believe it was May 4th. He signed an executive order pledging that his administration would respect religious freedom. Of course, he campaigned, as several Republicans did, saying that we would have greater religious liberty here than we did under the Obama administration, particularly when it came to the HHS mandate and Obamacare. Of course, that's the provision of Obamacare that says that all employers have to provide contraception, sterilization, and drugs that are potentially abortifacient to women with no copay.
Mm-hmm.
And so you saw several Christian universities, Colorado Christian, Houston Baptist, and others, sue the Obama administration over that provision. And those lawsuits are still tied up in the court system now. This past week, he rolled out several executive actions that are important, one of them being that he provided greater religious protection against the HHS mandate itself,
mm-hmm.
Not only for those who are classified as churches, but also for nonprofits, for closely held corporations like Hobby Lobby, which already had won a Supreme Court case giving it greater protection,
mm-hmm.
but also for some for-profit publicly traded corporations, saying that if you have a sincerely held religious objection, or if you have a moral objection, for example, you just believe that Ella, for example, the what's known as the week after pill, could potentially take the life of an unborn child, and you have a moral objection to that, that you do not have to comply with the HHS mandate. Also, last Friday, there was an executive guidance that came out from the Justice Department. Attorney General Jeff Sessions had two memoranda that came out, saying generally that the DOJ would respect religious liberty. The wording is wonderful. It allows for far greater religious liberty in the workplace than the Obama administration had understood. And what was really significant was this wording, and I'm going to quote it just for a second.
Okay.
It, quote, religious liberty is not merely a right to personal religious beliefs or even to worship in a sacred place. It also encompasses religious observance and practice, except in the narrow circumstances. No one should be forced to choose between living out his or her faith and complying with the law. The reason that's significant is you remember the last administration significantly tried to change the wording of the First Amendment to say the right to worship rather than the right to practice our religion. And the difference was not lost on most religious people. Our belief in Jesus Christ doesn't just take place when we're in church or when we're in worship, but our entire life is a prayer, the way that we live, both at home and in the marketplace, the way that we do our job. So that understanding is guiding this administration.
Mm-hmm. Now, Ben, this this memo does not necessarily break ground on something like the wedding case, the wedding vendor case of the baker. And, of course, that is going to be decided in June as to what the Supreme Court says about that. But it doesn't really break new ground on that, does it?
No, that's really the one significant area that is lacking in this memo. These two memoranda that came down from the Justice Department outlined 20 areas where this isn't an executive order. It's not a law. It's simply an understanding like the Obama administration had, for example, on transgender restrooms. The administration simply says, when we interpret the law, here's how we're going to interpret it.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've said is that we're going to interpret the law with the broadest possible understanding of what religious liberty is, including the 1993 Religious Freedom Restoration Act, the RFRA Act that Bill Clinton signed in the middle of the night in 1993. We're going to say that that applies to the greatest potential aspect of what people can do. And one of the quotations that's understood is that he says Americans don't give up their freedom of religion by participating in the marketplace, partaking in the public square, or interacting with the government.
Mm-hmm.
And they say specifically that this freedom of religion extends to persons and organizations, including some for-profit corporations. But you're right, there's no explicit mention of the LGBT community. And this is, of course, the primary concern for a lot of people. This is where a lot of the legislation and potential lawsuits, including some from the government, like in the state of Oregon, has taken place, where a baker or photographers refuse to take place in a homosexual wedding because mm-hmm. of their understanding of what a wedding ceremony is. And that's something that the court is going to have to decide. So this definitely could have been more robust.
Mm-hmm. Ben, I don't know about you, but when I was growing up, our philosophy, was, I'll take my business elsewhere. No, we don't do that anymore, do we?
No, now we take you to court.
Right.
And that's
and try to run you out of business.
That's the biggest problem.
Yeah.
Yeah. When all of these issues become politicized and the government has the power to regulate, the power to punish, the power to enact punitive sanctions against you, and the right to deny you business, then everything becomes politicized. And when things are politicized, that inherently stirs up conflict. Mm-hmm. In the old days, when we just left it to one another and your economic life was your life, mine was mine. If I didn't like the way you did business, I did business with somebody else.
Right.
If I didn't believe in what Coca-Cola was doing, I bought Pepsi and so on. You know, but today we don't do that because everything is politicized and the heavy hand of the government is going to come down, regulate everything that's taking place and possibly put you out of business if there's an opportunity to do so. So the more that government regulates, the more conflict there is inherently in society. We should simply leave these choices to individuals so that they can live out their moral lives, both in the way that they do business and the way that they act as consumers.
Mm-hmm. Ben, thank you for making me look smarter, because every time you come on the show, that's what you do.
Well, I think you have that in reverse, and you can only make me look smart. So I greatly appreciate it.
Yeah, well, I'm going to take a little break. When I come back, I want to ask you about an executive order on religious liberty. I think that the president signed in May. And I want to talk about the way we can strengthen protections for religious employers when I return. I'm speaking to Ben Johnson from the Acton Institute. We'll be back with Ben in just a minute. Minutes until the top of the hour, my highly esteemed guest on the studio line is Ben Johnson, senior editor of the Acton Institute. And we're talking about religious liberties this morning. And in I think it was in May, Ben, that President Trump signed an executive order on religious liberty, pretty much saying the government is never going to penalize any person for their protected religious beliefs. So that was an executive order, huh? Is that going to stick?
Well, the executive order, you're right, it was promulgated in May, and it was very similar to this guidance. It was essentially his understanding that the government, when it acts, will act in accordance with these principles. And President Trump has a great advantage over some of his predecessors in the fact that Barack Obama really passed very little legislation in all of the things that he did, for example, in threat to withhold federal funding from schools that don't allow transgender restrooms and things of that sort. All of that was done by executive action. There was never legislation passed on that front.
Mm-hmm.
You might remember when the Republicans took over the House in 2010, and then again when they took over the Senate, he said, "I have a pen and I have a phone."
Right.
And he continually circumnavigated Congress at every front. And I think in large part because of his legal background, he knew exactly which agency to have issued the executive order or action. And he used the full power of the executive government everywhere that he could in order to advance his agenda. Once he's out of office, though, I really believe he thought that there was no opportunity for any Republican to succeed him.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought eventually this would be codified.
Yeah.
Instead, President Trump was elected. It was kind of a shock to everybody, except maybe Donald Trump. And once he took office, he was able to take that pen and phone in hand himself and reverse a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, a lot of us have wondered why it is that the HHS mandate was still being enforced the way that it was, or at least that this action hadn't already taken place. And I think this is a great first step to reinstating some common sense religious protections that are rooted in the First Amendment that have always been understood to be of importance. And they're under threat not only with those that are dealt with in these three issues, the HHS mandate understanding as well as the two memoranda from the Justice Department. But this past Friday, we had a court rule once again against clergy taking a housing allowance. Something that's been long the practice of this country.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a great deal more yet to do. But the good news is that this administration is at least giving the right signals on all of these issues and taking some significant action.
Now, Ben, will there be a more secure sense for corporations and churches and nonprofits and groups that have pretty much religious work their primary activity?
I think there definitely will. You know, when President Trump ran in 2016, one of the primary promises that he made had to do with the Johnson Amendment, repealing the Johnson Amendment, allowing churches to formally endorse candidates should they so desire. I think that he is going to do his best on that front. But already we're seeing a lot more religious freedom for corporations and for those of us who live out our faith in the workplace day in and day out. As we say, our faith isn't something that we just check out Sunday morning and then leave it you know, at the church door when we leave Sunday afternoon. It's something that we live out. It's embedded in our hearts. God himself, through the Holy Spirit, leads and guides the way that we interact with others, including the choices that we make in the executive suite, in our workplace, on the shop floor, wherever we are, day in and day out. Because of that, we understand that we should have the right to live out our religious liberty. And I think that we have two reasons for hope. Not only these actions which have been taken, again, they're fairly minor first steps, but they're very significant first steps.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that they have been taken tells us where this administration is headed, and there are good people who are willing to take the right steps on all of these issues from an executive position. But more importantly, the more power that the government has to regulate or to take punitive action, the greater likelihood that that action is going to be taken against the church. The church and the government have been in conflict for as long as the two have been in power against each other. You can think about the Babylonian Empire, Daniel and the fiery furnace. The government has always tried to stamp out true religious liberty. And whenever government was limited, that's when churches flourish. And when churches flourish, society flourishes, because then it's the power of the Holy Spirit moving through us freely, and we're able to live out our life and benefit everyone around us.
Mm-hmm. Ben, with the time remaining, I want to ask you about the ways economic freedom will benefit the poor globally, but I want to start with a quote from Thomas Sowell. He said, "The first lesson of economics is scarcity. There is never enough of anything to fully satisfy all those who want it. The first lesson of politics is to disregard the first lesson of economics."
Thomas Sowell, prescient as always, yes. Matter of fact, you know, I was just at the European Liberty Forum in Budapest, and the Lithuanian Free Market Institute just released a study on scarcity. And they reviewed it from a mostly moral and religious perspective. It was really sort of breathtaking. And they talked about how when the government gets involved trying to regulate things, we inevitably run out of money, and the churches are usually the ones who pay for it. Consequently, when the government is not so involved, it's the church that has a free hand to help, and all others flourish as a result.
Mm-hmm. So, Ben, tell me again where you were at. I'm curious again.
I was at a forum in Budapest where that was taking place. It was an honor to be there on behalf.
Okay,
of
yeah.
The
well, I was at a yeah. water park at the Wisconsin Dells, so you know we're kind of.
Well, I'm sure you had a beautiful view. So
I did. So okay, let's talk about the ways economic freedom will benefit the poor.
Yeah, well, there was a study recently released by the Fraser Institute in Canada. And what it found was that even being in relationship in a society where there's more money benefits you, as opposed to being an average person in a very poor society,
mm-hmm.
Which should make a lot of sense. But the way that they did that, they examined economic freedom. That is, the less government regulation, taxes, redistribution of wealth, the greater economic freedom there was, the more prosperity there was. And they found that people who live in the most economically free nations live 16 years longer on
wow.
average than those
in
the least free.
Yeah. That's amazing.
So, you know, you have the poorest 10% in free countries earn 10 times as much money as the poorest people in unfree nations. In fact, the poorest 10% earn more money than the average person in the least free nations.
Hmm.
So when we say that our poor people live better than wealthy people in other societies, we're not kidding.
Yeah, no.
The poorest tenth here make at least twice as much than in economically repressed nations. They live longer. They have greater access to health care. They enjoy greater civil liberties, more equality, and greater levels of happiness when they are surveyed about this. and greater literacy, as well as greater religious freedom. It's pretty significant when they measure religious liberty. They track very carefully, very closely with economic freedom. When you look at the most economically free nations, there's only one that is really economically repressive, and religiously oppressive, mm-hmm. and vice versa. When you look at, you think of the most religiously repressive regimes, Iran, North Korea, these are regimes, Cuba, these are places that are not economically free either. Mm-hmm. Again, when the government has the ability to determine whether you live or not, then the government has the ability to determine everything about your life, including your religion. When you own something, you have the ability to sustain yourself. That gives you the right and the freedom and the ability to live your life and to choose your beliefs on your own. Mm. The more that you have the ability to sustain yourself, the greater rights you are able to demand on behalf of the government, and vice versa. The more the power is concentrated, the more it can demand of you.
Mm. Ben Johnson, please come on the show more often. I just love having you as a guest.
Well, the pleasure, again, is all mine, and the Wisconsin Dells are very pretty.
Thank you so much. I agree.
Hope you enjoy
it. I agree. All right. Ben Johnson, senior editor from the Acton Institute. We'll take a short break and be back with more of the Early Morning Late Show. Good morning. It's a couple minutes in front of the hour. We're going to have a great second hour. I can't wait to talk about expanding shoes, the shoes that grow. We're going to talk to the inventor in just a minute, and then we're going to talk to Ron Deal from Family Life Blended on the getting cholesterol out of your marriage. So that's going to be what we're doing in the second hour. I hope your start to your day as well. Thanks for staying with us. Be back in a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.